bio dad situation or a religion situation, not both at the same time. But now that I've got to leave for my flight, I have no choice. It'd be weird to wait until I get back to tell the most significant person in my life. Okay, Stephen says as he takes in the introduction to my announcement. And actually, I have something big to tell you, too. Okay, I say, kind of puzzled. Well, you go first, because mine's pretty big.
No, you go first. Mine's really big,
Stephen says confidently. Look, just go, please.
All right, Stephen says with a weighted exhale. I am Jesus Christ reincarnated.
Huh? My first instinct is to burst out laughing. The kind of uncomfortable laugh that's an automatic result of shock, sadness, anger, and disbelief combined. Stephen thinks he's Jesus, our Lord and Savior Christ. Come on, he's got to be kidding me. The second I realize he's not, my second instinct hits me. I want to cry. I want to just crumple into myself and let it all out.
You've got to believe me, Jenny, Stephen says with gravity. I know it sounds crazy, but you've got to believe me.
I shake myself off and go puke in the bathroom while I come up with a game plan. By the time I get back, I'm trying to figure out if there's anything I can do about my boyfriend thinking he's Jesus Christ in the minutes I have left before I need to head out. It's clear Stephen is unwell, but I have no one to tell that information to who would be helpful in any way. I don't have any of the phone numbers for his family members or friends. Our relationship is too new for that. I try and discreetly ask for the phone number of one of his friends that lives nearby, but Stephen bursts into tears, begging me to not tell anyone the secret I told him.
It's just between me and you, Jenny,
he cries.
I think you should tell your family,
I urge him, knowing that if he does, they'll see that something's up and likely fly down to take care of him.
I can't, he says, shaking his head. I just can't. They won't believe me. Only you'll believe me, Jenny.
I don't respond. There's nothing left in me to respond with. I am powerless and distraught. Stephen is my first real love. Up until 10 minutes ago, the joy I've gotten from this relationship has been the only positive thing in my life recently. I'm not ready to let go. I wipe a tear away with my sleeve, and my eye catches the clock on the wall. I'm gonna be late. I have to leave. I hug Stephen. He hugs me back. I get a text from my manager on the way to the airport. Robin Wright has confirmed. The flight to Sydney is 14 hours of puking in an airplane bathroom hell. I eat 2 full in-flight meals and puke them both up, plus the near-constant stream of snacks that the flight attendant offers. Gummy bears, graham crackers, Doritos. Every last snack is down, up, and out for me. It's chaos. There's not one moment of the flight where I'm not eating or throwing up or in the time between the eating and the throwing up, planning how to get up for the 14th time without getting a weird stare from the businessman in the toupee sitting next to me. By the last time I throw up, I feel like I'm about to pass out. My mouth feels sour from the vomit and sore from the act of vomiting. I shove my fingers down my throat, my eyes bulging as a byproduct, and with the brown, chunky fluid that pours out of my mouth and into the gray toilet bowl like an ugly waterfall, I spot a small, white, hard chunk. I run my tongue along my teeth and realize one of them is missing. The acidity from my stomach fluids has worn down my enamel to the point that I just lost a lower left molar. I taste pennies and spit into the sink, a stream of blood. I reluctantly cut my hand under the airplane bathroom sink and wash my mouth out with the questionable water. I do this 4 or 5 times before catching my reflection in the mirror. I try and avoid it, but I can't. Not in a space this small with a mirror this big. I look at myself for a long beat. I don't like what I see. We touch down in Sydney. As I walk toward the Nissan Sentra that's waiting for me, I see on my phone that there's a voicemail from an unknown number. I swipe my phone open to check it. It's Stephen's parents. They tell me that Stephen called them, frantic, and that they were so concerned that they flew out to visit him. They're with him now at a mental facility to run some tests because a psychiatrist there thinks that Stephen might have schizophrenia. I finish the message and get into the backseat of the car.
Hey, how's it going? The upbeat Uber driver asks.
I look straight ahead, not answering the driver.
How's it going?
It's going fucking terribly. Mom lied my entire life about who my biological father was. I'm caught in the undertow of bulimia. I'm gonna have to do an entire press junket while missing a lower left molar. And my boyfriend's schizophrenic. It could not be going any worse.
Ooh, I love this song. You mind if I turn it up?
The Uber driver cranks up the volume knob before waiting for my answer. It's Ariana Grande's hit single, Focus on Me.
It's even better than her last single, huh?
The driver asks. He bobs his head and hums along, beats the dashboard with enthusiasm. I look out the window and see the Sydney Opera House in the distance. I tongue my missing molar, deep in thought. Maybe Ariana's got a point. Maybe it's time to focus on me. Seventy-eight. Hello, Jeanette.
Hi, Jeff.
Why don't you go ahead and step on the scale?
Ahem. Excuse me? Nowhere in my consultation paperwork was there a clause stating that I would have to weigh myself at the first session with this eating disorder specialist I found online. If I'd read that, I'm not sure I would have booked the appointment. And even if I had somehow managed to still book the appointment, I would have worn my getting weight in public outfit, which I wear to every doctor's appointment I have, regardless of the weather. A poplin skirt and my thinnest tank top. I want my clothes to add as little weight as possible. I never would have worn jeans. Goddamned thick, heavy jeans. And a sweater. A lumpy, hefty, cable-knit sweater.
Do I have to?
Yes. But you don't have to look at the number, and I won't tell it to you. It's simply for my clinical purposes. I'll need to document your weight at the start of each session.
I wring my hands with agitation.
You seem upset.
I don't want to be weighed.
This is just part of the process, and I totally understand how it might be upsetting. To be honest, your reaction is mild compared to a lot of what I see.
What do you see?
People start sobbing. Sometimes they yell. Someone threw her purse across the room once. That was fun.
I laugh.
Facing your emotional experience is going to be the most transformative part of your recovery. That starts with facing your emotional experience around food, eating, your body, and, yes, getting weighed. I'll be here to help you through all of it, but if you want to get better, you're going to need to face all of it.
Doesn't sound like there's much wiggle room, Jeff.
He chuckles, and then his chuckle ends abruptly, and he doesn't say anything. He just keeps looking at me. Jeff is tall, 6'3" maybe, with kind blue eyes and a perfectly trimmed blonde beard to match his perfectly styled blonde hair, neatly swept to one side. He wears slacks, a checkered button-down with a tie, and a black belt with a silver buckle. His gestures are as exact as his phrasing. No uhs or ums in speech or in mannerisms. This is an umless man. I respect him. It takes a lot to be an umless man. I get up and walk over to the scale. I shut my eyes and take a long inhale, then step on it. I hear him make a note on his clipboard.
You can step off now.
I do. I return to the couch and sit on it. Jeff smiles at me. There's a little warmth to his smile, but it's more so the smile of someone who means business. Let's get to work.
I can't believe I ever thought I was Jesus, Stephen says with a laugh as he eats a fry.
We're sitting across from each other at a table at Laurel Tavern, a bar in Studio City. I'm nursing a mezcal mule and taking in Stephen the way I used to take in my mother after any of her brushes with death that she survived. It's a pure way of taking somebody in. There's a grateful astonishment. They're here. They're still here. I thought Stephen's trip to the psychiatric ward might be the last I'd hear from him, but as soon as he had access to his phone again, he called. We both wept. He sounded like his usual self, sort of. There was more lethargy to his tone, a numbness that didn't used to be there. He told me this was due to the lithium he was taking and that, with time, he'd get back to his old pre-diagnosis self. I wanted desperately for that to be the case. And now, sitting across from him 2 months later, I'm starting to think it might be. We're living together again, and he seems to be doing well. He's actively seeing a therapist and psychiatrist. He's on medication. His vow of celibacy is over, and we're having great sex. He's making light of his schizophrenic episode, the way you can only do when the thing you're making light of is truly a thing of the past.
I can't believe it either. I agree.
Stephen takes my hands in his from across the table. His fingers are greasy from the fries. I don't mind.
That must have been so scary, he says.
It was.
I'm sorry it wasn't there for you.
It's okay. I really couldn't be there for you either, honestly, with everything going on.
I know. But we're both working on our stuff now. We're going to be able to be there for each other. It's going to be so good.
I nod. I believe him. 80. I'm staring at the plate of spaghetti in front of me. I've been staring at it for at least 10 minutes while I process all the thoughts and emotions that are coming up for me before eating it. I pick up my pencil and start filling out my worksheet. Thoughts. I want this spaghetti, but I don't want this spaghetti. I'm terrified that this will make me heavy. I don't want to feel bogged down. I don't want to feel heaviness. I'm tired of feeling so much heaviness. I'm scared of eating. I don't want to throw this up. Feelings. Dread, 8 of 10. Anxiety, 8 of 10. Fear, 7 of 10. Lust, 6 of 10. I take a deep breath and then I take a bite. More thoughts, more feelings. Always more thoughts and feelings. Exhausting, constant thoughts and feelings. I go back to my worksheet to start writing them down. Thoughts while eating. Mom always said sodium made my face puffy. I'm scared my face is going to be puffy tomorrow. Mom would be mad if she saw me eating this. Mom would be disappointed. I'm a failure. Feelings. Sadness, 8 of 10. Disappointment, 8 of 10. I start to cry. I set my pencil down and let the tears fall as instructed by Jeff. I've been seeing Jeff for 3 months now, and the progress is slow but steady. We've done so much work it's hard to keep track of it at this point. The work started with me throwing out all diet foods, lean cuisine frozen dinners, diet cranberry juice, diet teas, etc., as well as all gym clothes.
No working out during this phase of recovery. Stretching and reasonable walks are fine, but no half marathons for me anymore. All indicators of diet had to go. Then I was told to track my binges and purges for 2 weeks, as well as every single thing I ate and the time that I ate it. Tracking my purges made sense to me. That was a thing Laura had me do, so I expected it. But tracking my food intake confused me. Isn't tracking food a part of disordered eating? Isn't it a compulsive, unhealthy thing to do? Yes, tracking what you eat is going to be a behavior that we want to knock out with time. In fact, eventually, I'll have you keep a tally on how often you track so that we can work toward getting that number to zero. So, tracking. Slight chuckle, abrupt ending. Correct. All right, so then why am I tracking my foods now if I'm supposed to work toward not tracking them? I need to get a sense of your behaviors around food. Seeing what goes into your body and when will help me understand that. After 2 weeks of tracking, Jeff reads over my worksheets while stroking his beard. Yes, interesting. Yes. What, Jeff, what? Interesting. What's interesting? I finally ask when I can't hold it in any longer. So, you skip breakfast almost every day, and then you eat a late lunch around 2:30 or 3 p.m., but it's not really a lunch. It's not a full meal. I'm seeing 8 bites of salmon on Tuesday, very specific, a protein bar on Wednesday, 2 eggs on Thursday. Why did you purge the eggs? I shrug. We'll get there. Okay, so you're having these very late, incomplete lunches, and then around 8 p.m. it looks like you have dinner, which is also incomplete every night. Then, and here's where things start to really click, around 11 p.m. you have what you describe as a binge, an entire plate of pad thai with fried rice plus a burrito from Del Taco. And then it looks like you purge whatever you eat around that time every night. Yes, I know, Jeff. I wrote the list. Right, I say, pretending like I'm learning something. So here's the thing, Jeanette. You're starving yourself for the first part of the day. You're not eating breakfast. You're having late and incomplete lunches and dinners. And then you're so famished by 11 p.m. that you're eating because your body is begging you for it. And it makes perfect sense, the foods you're choosing to eat around this time, because you're so famished, you want something hearty, something that will sustain you. But then, of course, because of your judgments around those foods and because of your deeply entrenched destructive thought patterns, you purge them up and then repeat the cycle the next day. Honestly, this was a good week, I explain. I think because I want to do well in therapy or whatever. That makes sense, Jeff assures me. No need to overanalyze it. Just take it as it is, a step up. He nods politely, then lowers his chin and looks at me with determination. But I think we're capable of more. I believe him. He's so sure. And an umless man isn't sure of something for no reason. An umless man is sure of things that he is sure of. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to normalize your eating. 3 full meals a day and 2 snacks, each at predetermined times. No negotiations. Before starting the eating normalization process, we need to identify your risky foods. Risky foods are the foods you have a lot of judgment around, the foods you feel more compelled to purge. Don't have to tell me twice. I start rattling off a list. Cakes, pies, ice cream, sandwiches, french fries, bread, cheese, butter, chips, cookies, pasta. Great, Jeff says as he takes rigorous notes but refuses to ask me to slow down. It's the achiever in him, I can tell. The pen flies. He's going for the gold. He crosses the T in pasta and looks up at me. So one of our ultimate goals here in therapy is to reduce judgment around food. All judgment. We want you to neutralize food. It's just a thing you eat, neither good nor bad, regardless of whether it's pineapple or pancakes. I see both of those as bad because they both have a lot of sugar. Jeff blinks once. Right, so that's what we're going to work on. Okay. And I'll warn you, Jeanette, normalizing your eating patterns and mentally neutralizing food is not going to be easy at all. It's going to be hard emotional work. For so long, your eating has been so fucked up. Didn't expect that F-bomb, Jeff, but I appreciate the fervor. It's going to be intense, but I'll help you through it. I'm sitting here with my salty tears falling onto my plate of spaghetti, watering down the marinara sauce. Jeff was right. Normalizing my eating and neutralizing food is hard emotional work. The crying gets heavier to where my chest starts heaving. I get mad at myself for crying. It makes me feel dramatic. Out of control. Tears fall onto my worksheet and blur the ink. Fuck. I try to blow on the wet spot to dry it, but snot drips out of my nose and falls onto the page and makes it worse. I crumple the worksheet into a ball and throw it across the room toward the trash can. It doesn't land anywhere close. Jesus Christ. Fuck it. I get up, hurry to the bathroom, and purge. Slips are totally normal. When you have a slip, it's just that, a slip. It doesn't define you, it doesn't make you a failure. The most important thing is that you don't let that slip become a slide, Jeff tells me, and then he hands me a packet titled, Don't Let Slips Become Slides. I have a feeling he rehearsed this moment. Say it, then hand them the packet. Yeah, that'll hit home.
These packets are a weekly occurrence with Jeff. At the end of every session, he hands me a new one. Usually they include an article, maybe a quiz or two, and some worksheets. The topics have a wide range. Everything from how to establish healthy relationships and take stock of your current ones, to building an identity without your eating disorder, to what is self-care, actually. I enjoy doing the packets. I like that I'm able to get myself on paper. It simplifies things for me. When everything's in my head, it feels chaotic and jumbled. But when I can look down at a sheet of paper and see myself reflected back in words and tallies and graphs, it's clarifying. The packets always reiterate whatever our session was about, so I know today's session is going to be about slips.
Jeanette, this is going to be one of the most important parts of recovery, accepting slips and moving on from them.
I nod.
People with a propensity for eating disorders tend to be the types of people who get very caught up in their mistakes and struggle to move on from them. Perfectionists. Does that resonate?
Yeah. The label's a little annoying, but it resonates.
The problem with this is that if we beat ourselves up after a mistake, we add shame onto the guilt and frustration that we already feel about our mistake. That guilt and frustration can be helpful in moving us forward, but shame keeps us stuck. It's a paralyzing emotion. When we get caught in a shame spiral, we tend to make more of the same kinds of mistakes that caused us shame in the first place.
I nod, catching on. So it makes slips become slides. Jeff points at me with pride.
Bingo.
I could have done without the bingo, but the point connects with me in a deep and powerful way. I'm realizing how much shame spirals have contributed to my issues. I'm so tired of swearing over and over again that this time I'm done for real. Maybe this acceptance of slips is the missing piece. Maybe when I have a slip, I can acknowledge how disappointing and frustrating it is without getting caught in the shame spiral, without letting that spiral lead to more slips and more slips and more slips until they've become a slide. Maybe now a slip can be, as Jeff says, just that, a slip. Shit, I'm running late for a meeting. I grab my bag and hurry downstairs when I see him sitting there, looking out the window and twirling his hair with his index finger. His expression is catatonic, the way it often is lately. It scares me when I see him like this. The first time it happened, I thought maybe it was because he was on too high a dose of lithium. But the lithium dose has been adjusted a dozen times, and the catatonia hasn't stopped. That's when I realized it was something else. "Hey, boy," I say, trying to sound as casual as possible. "How's it going?" He doesn't seem to hear me. "Steven?" "Nothing." I bite my lip. I have to go to a meeting. Do you want to come along for the ride? You can maybe walk around while I'm in there. Shouldn't be more than an hour. I've started inviting Steven to come along with me whenever I have appointments or work or meetings. I'm afraid he won't leave the house otherwise. Steven has completely stopped working and seems opposed to ever returning to it. He claims work is a waste of life. He has no hobbies and isn't interested in spending time with his friends. The only thing Steven does these days is smoke weed. He wakes up in the morning and smokes immediately, then continuously smokes throughout the day. He's high every minute he's awake. So high. Higher than I've ever seen anyone. Catatonia level high. At first I thought it was okay. It seemed like a reprieve for him from his schizophrenia diagnosis and all the overwhelm that came with it. I tried to be supportive. I even helped him find a dealer who could get him the amount he wanted, which seemed to be a lot. But then it became this. And it's not that I don't understand this. I do. I very much understand the need to numb out everything in your life. But I'm not numbing out anymore. And maybe that's the problem here, for us at least. I'm making strides in my bulimia recovery. I'm no longer abusing my body to nearly the extent that I used to. I'm trying every day to face myself. The results vary, but the attempts are consistent. The further into my recovery I get, the further into his drug of choice Steven gets, and the further away from each other we grow. And so a few weeks ago, I had the brilliant idea that I'd get us back on the same page, whatever it took. Steven tried to help me with my bulimia, so I'll try and help him with his marijuana addiction. I printed out a bunch of articles about how to quit smoking weed. I looked up support groups. I suggested he try a new therapist who specialized in addiction. I planned activities for us so we'd be out and about and he'd be less likely to use. I invited him everywhere I went so I could monitor him. I pitched him on potential hobbies to take up. I threw away his weed. Nothing has worked. He won't read the articles. He won't go to the support groups. He won't try a new therapist and even quit going to his current one. He doesn't want a hobby. He bought more weed. I'm helpless. I'm powerless over him. But I love him. And I want us to be together, so I'll keep trying. So do you want to come? I ask him again.
Nah, Jenny, I'm just gonna stay here. But thanks for inviting me,
he says as he keeps twirling his hair.
83.
Bob, did you hear her? She ran out of all her money.
Grandma wails, then throws her head on Grandpa's shoulder and weeps a tearless weep into it. Grandma's not even a Weller.
She didn't say anything like that, hun, Grandpa assures her with more patience than I understand.
I'm sitting with my grandparents in the living room of my Studio City home. I still have Grandma blocked, but she won't let Grandpa see me without her tagging along. I've just broken the news to them that I'll be selling my house. The news is not going over well.
What am I going to tell Linda and Joni and Louise?
Grandma yells with her arms flailing in confusion. I think you can just tell them the truth, I offer.
That my granddaughter, who I love more than anything on this entire planet, decided willy-nilly to up and move out of her beautiful home and into a measly little one-bedroom apartment?
Sure.
No!
It's gonna be okay, hon, Grandpa tells Grandma with a pat on her hand.
The areas in my life that cause me stress is a topic I discuss often in therapy with Jeff. My house has come up enough that Jeff asked why I don't sell it. Well, I've wanted to sell it for a while, but I can't do that. Why not? Jeff asks.
Because it's not smart.
Why is it not smart?
Because a home is a good investment.
Tell me what's stressful about your home.
Well, it's constantly falling apart. There's always something to fix. A contractor comes by almost every day. I didn't realize homeownership was going to be another job, a job I'm not interested in and don't have the time for.
Anything else?
It feels lonely and kind of scary. It's too big for me, and I don't like the neighborhood. And somebody leaked my address online, so I've had a couple stalkers who show up sometimes and leave creepy notes, and one time one of them left a bouquet of roses dripping with blood.
That's a lot of stressful things.
Yeah.
And you're not selling it because it's a good investment?
Yeah.
What about it makes it a good investment?
I'm not exactly sure. It's just sort of a thing I've heard, you know? Everybody says a home is a good investment. A good investment for one person might be a bad investment for another.
Okay. What about your investment in your mental health? Feeling safe is important to mental health, and you mentioned that you don't feel safe.
I don't, but I don't know. I don't think I can sell it.
Jeff holds an unblinking stare at me.
I could buy some plants. I shrug. The amount of times I've thought buying plants might make a difference in my life is staggering.
Any other ideas? Jeff asks.
I could take more vacations.
But that doesn't directly impact your main environment, your home, which is the main environment that influences your mental health. So why don't we stay focused on the home?
But no plants.
Bigger than plants, Jeff nods.
I could hire an interior decorator.
Okay, and how would that reduce your stress?
Well, the house is kind of empty looking and feeling. It feels lonely.
And some rugs are going to help that?
They might, I say with a little sauce. Don't love that judgy question, Jeff.
All right, Jeff says simply. Then why don't we start there?
I get home and call my realtor to ask if he knows of any good interior decorators. He says he knows just the one.
Liz shows up at my place in a black flowy top and cheetah print leggings. I should have known then. Shania Twain is the only person on Earth who should be allowed to go anywhere near cheetah print.
So how would you describe your home style? Liz asks as she sits down at the dining table.
She plops her big bucket bag on it and starts pulling out scraps of fabric, binders of materials, and thick home magazines.
I look around the empty room. I have no clue. I was thinking I'd just go with whatever you were thinking.
Ooh, excellent, Liz says excitedly. I have lots of ideas. I think the front runner is glamour chic with animal print accents.
I do everything in my power to avoid looking at her leggings. Not a huge fan of animal print.
Oh, she says, slightly offended. Well, it would just be subtle accents. We could do some cheetah print or cow print or zebra print. That's very in right now.
Why are you pushing zebras on me, Liz? I don't want zebra print on my pillows or my blankets or my curtains. It's a thing I've never understood, why we have to go and try to make pillows and blankets and curtains fun with prints. These things aren't fun, they're functional. Give me some simple, solid-colored, coordinating furniture and let's call it a day.
That's okay, I say as delicately as I can. I just want simple stuff. I don't have an eye for it, but I know I want simple. But you're so young and fun. Don't you want your space to reflect that?
No.
Why don't we just try it? Why don't we just start with this plan and then anything you don't like, I can return, except for the things that are non-refundable.
A pushover is a bad thing to be, but an opinionated pushover is a worse thing to be. A pushover is nice and goes along with it, whatever it is. An opinionated pushover acts nice and goes along with it, but while quietly brooding and resentful. I am an opinionated pushover.
Okay, I say politely, brooding.
3 days later, mint and cream cheetah print curtains show up at my doorstep with a receipt. $14,742. Liz is clearly used to working with clients who don't mind dropping $15,000 to block the sun,
but I am not one of those clients. Prints and pricing aside, I'm starting to accept that it doesn't matter what kind of blankets or curtains or pillows I have. They won't make up for the constant construction and the loneliness and the stalkers with the bloody roses. I can't be in this house. I call Liz to tell her I won't be needing her services anymore.
Well, I am disappointed, she tells me, but I totally understand and wish you the best of luck with decorating your home.
Thanks, but actually I think I'm going to sell it.
Oh?
Yep.
Well, okay.
Yeah, so anyway, let me know where you want me to drop off the cheetah curtains so you can return them.
Oh, those are non-refundable.
Now, days later, I'm trying to reason with Grandma. I don't understand why me selling this house is such a big deal to you.
Because, Grandma shouts,
I always forget that trying to reason with the unreasonable is unreasonable. This is what's best for me, and I'd really appreciate if you'd support the decision.
Well, I don't. I just don't.
Grandma buries her head in Grandpa's armpit. It's all right, hun. It's gonna be all right, Grandpa tells her.
Where are you even gonna be moving to, doll?
Grandma asks with a sniffle. I'm moving into an apartment above the Americana.
The Americana?
Grandma turns to face me, sniffleless.
That fancy shopping center with the fountain and the Frank Sinatra music?
That's the one. She hesitates.
I guess it won't be that bad. They do have an Ann Taylor loft there.
Is this trying too hard? I ask Colton and Miranda. They're helping me pick out the outfit I'm going to wear to the big event.
I'd take off the skirt. It's a little much, Colton tells me.
I appreciate his honesty and grab some jeans instead.
Better, he nods. What if he doesn't like me? I shout to them as I head into the bathroom to change. He's going to like you,
Miranda calls out to assure me. I'm so jittery. I'm way more nervous than I've ever been to go on a first date. Maybe because the stakes are higher. This isn't just any first date. This is my first date with my biological dad. We're in Miranda's Porsche on the 405 as we head down to Newport Beach to the hotel where the concert is happening.
So your bio dad plays the trumpet?
Colton asks as we get close to the destination.
Trombone,
I correct him. Same thing, Colton says with a shrug. I know he's trying to keep the conversation going because the mood's gotten heavier the closer we've gotten to the hotel. With good reason. I'm showing up unannounced at the jazz concert performed by my biological father, who I'm not sure even knows I exist. Even though I wasn't able to find out much from Mark Dad about the situation, I was able to get Bio Dad's full name and occupation, which was enough for a quick online search to lead me to his official website. He had a list of credits that he's played on the soundtracks of, various Star Wars films, Jurassic World, Lost, and countless others, and a list of upcoming tour dates for his fun side passion project, a jazz band. I chose the latest possible LA area date to attend, because I wanted as much time as possible to emotionally prepare. And now here I am. Minutes away from this concert, and months since I'd first decided to come, and I still don't feel emotionally prepared. Does Andrew know he's my father? Does he know he's Dustin and Scott's father? Was he ever around when I was little? Where did he and Mom leave off? Did he keep in touch with her? Does he know she's dead? Does he have a family now? Do they know about this situation? I have so many questions, and the range of possibilities of answers is unsettling to me. I've considered the possibility that he has a family, that his kids might be at the show, and that they might not know. And I don't want to be the one to introduce this news into their lives. So I've decided that I'll approach him at the end of the concert, as soon as he's leaving the stage, and only if he's alone. I've also considered that maybe he'll deny it. Maybe he'll say, fuck off. Maybe he won't know. I have no idea what I'm in for. Miranda pulls up to the ballet, and we all hop out of the car. Colton grabs my arm for comfort. Miranda doesn't. So many female friendships seem so rooted in physical contact, the clutching of hands, constant hugging, hair touching, whatever. Miranda and I have a friendship that is not entirely void of physical contact, but almost. Hugs between us are rare, and it feels right. We walk through the hotel corridors, and I stop at the bathroom to pee. Miranda comes with me, I think, to make sure I'm not vomiting. She's never told me this directly, but I can tell. She doesn't come with me every time. She's not the obvious type. Typically, I'd feel agitated, the way I would when Steven always tried to intercept a purge. But not this time, because this time I'm not planning on it. There's nothing in my body to purge. I've felt nauseous all day and unable to eat. I've made a mental note to bring this up in therapy tomorrow, but for today, I just want to get through. I wash my hands for a long time, hoping this will rid them of their clamminess. I add more mascara and a little more blush. Why am I so concerned with how I look around my bio dad? I've noticed this all day long. I stuff my mascara back into my bag and we head through the hotel and out to the courtyard where the gig is happening. I hate the word gig, but I'm pretty sure that's the proper term for this. Colton, Miranda, and I sit at a table near the back a few minutes before the show starts. The crowd is mostly folks in their 40s and 50s, wealthy looking, a lot of Gucci. What brings you kids here? The woman sitting next to me, wine-drunk and pearls-clad, asks. I think about saying, well, my biological father, who I've never met, plays a trombone in this band, so I was just going to accost him after the show to try and find answers about my dysfunctional mess of a childhood. But I don't. We just like jazz, Colton says finally, after he realizes there's nothing more than a blank stare coming from my end.
Oh, that's good. We need more young people like you.
Cultured. Which jazz bands do you like?
Just all of them. The whole...
All of them, Colton nods.
Great, great,
Pearls responds with a smile, seemingly satisfied by that non-answer.
Oh, here they are.
Pearls claps ecstatically, and the three of us turn to see the band walking out onto the stage. I laser in on my dad, carrying his trombone. I can't say I see a resemblance. Maybe I'm sitting too far back. Or maybe Mom's jeans were stronger. The band starts playing. Colton grabs my hand a few times. Miranda watches me out of the corner of her eye. I feel like I'm in a trance the whole time the band's playing. An hour later, the saxophonist announces they're on their last song. My mouth goes dry, my hands are drenched, my heart is pounding.
Okay, let's go, Colton says, taking my hand.
The three of us get up from the table and head toward the stage exit.
Where are you guys going?
Not now, Pearls. The final song is coming to the final measures, and we're not yet to the stage exit. We pick up the pace. You can't come here, the security guard tells us. Sorry, she has a quick thing she has to do, Colton says with the confidence of someone who's giving legitimate information. The security guard is confused enough to let us pass. I look up and see him crossing off the stage. My biological dad.
Hurry,
Miranda says. I run the last 30 yards or so until I get to him just as he's walking down the stage steps. He feels me. We make eye contact. He looks puzzled, maybe a little alarmed. I think we have something in common, is what comes out of my mouth. His eyes well with tears. Mine do too. The next 10 minutes are an informational exchange of a blur. I ask him if he knew about me, that I existed. He says yes. And my brothers. He says that he's been waiting for us to contact him. He didn't want to contact us because he wasn't sure if we knew. He asks how I found out. I tell him. He says things ended poorly with Mom and that there was a big custody battle when we were little, that Mom said he was physically abusive. He assures me he wasn't. She won. I ask him if he knew Mom died. He says yes, he saw it on E! News. I think about what a strange sentence that is. Tech people start telling us we have to move. Biodad gives me his phone number and tells me to text him. We hug and say goodbye. Miranda and Colton come over to me. I'm having a lot of feelings, and I can identify what they are. It feels like progress. I'm glad he knew he existed. I'm relieved to have this event over with. I'm disappointed by the brevity of it. I'm confused and sad that he didn't reach out to me first. I will never know for sure if he wanted to meet me, or if he's just saying it because that's what you're supposed to say. As far as first dates go, this has certainly been the most interesting one I've been on. I'm not sure if there will be a second. It's cold and heavy in my hands. I walk slowly with it because I'm stalling. I've gotten rid of it before, 7 or 8 times, but every time I go right back out the next day and get a new one. So far, I haven't been able to get through 24 hours without getting a new one, but I'm hopeful that this time might be different. Maybe this time, since I'm making it more of an occasion, since my getting rid of it is my gift to myself for my 24th birthday, I'll be able to get rid of it for good. My scale has defined me for so long. The number it shows tells me whether I'm succeeding or failing, whether I'm trying hard enough or not, whether I'm good or bad. I know it's unhealthy for anything to have that much authority over my self-worth, but no matter how hard I've tried to fight it, I have always felt reduced to the number on the scale. Maybe because, in a way, it's easier. Defining yourself is hard, complicated, messy. Letting the number on the scale do it for you is simple, direct, straightforward. I am 95 pounds, or 105 pounds, or 115 pounds, or 125 pounds. Whatever the scale reads, I am that and only that. That is who I am. Or rather, who I was. I no longer want that number to be the entirety of who I am, to define me. I am ready to experience life beyond the scale. It sounds ridiculous, life beyond the scale. It's so dramatic, but unfortunately true for me. I'm embarrassed that this is my reality. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's growth, to be embarrassed. I approach the trash room and pull down the latch to open the chute door. I drop the scale into the chute. I hear the scale slide down it, banging against the sides of it as it falls. It lands. I leave. The next day comes and goes. I don't get a new scale. We're sitting in a swan boat on Echo Park Lake. A goddamned hideous swan boat.
Neither of us have said a word for the past 5 minutes, which feels like a lot more than 5 minutes when you're sitting in a goddamned swan boat. I'm staring at Stephen. He doesn't feel me staring. He's looking off into the distance, half wistfully, half depressed. He's so contemplative these days, but in the way that gets you nowhere. It's the way that makes your wheels spin and your thoughts keep going in circles, but there's no forward movement. I tried for so long to help Stephen, or to control him. I'm not sure which, since they're so closely related. But a few months ago, I gave up. It started with Jeff giving me some materials to read on codependency. Everything I read resonated a little too much and forced me to accept that Stephen and I were in a deeply codependent relationship. Jeff suggested I stay focused on trying to solve my own problems. But I'm here, I am trying to solve my problems.
And you're doing a great job, Jeff nodded, affirming. But I have a feeling you might be able to make more progress if you take all that energy you're spending trying to manage Stephen's life and instead put it toward managing your own.
The shift happened quickly. Per Jeff's suggestion, I added group therapy to my weekly self-improvement regimen. I read more books on eating disorder recovery. The more time I spent focused on my issues, the less time I had to focus on Stephen's. And the less I was focusing on Stephen's, the further apart we grew. It's been sad to recognize how much fixing has been the backbone of our relationship. Whether it was Stephen trying to fix my bulimia or me trying to fix his marijuana addiction or pushing him to find the right cocktail of medication, it's been the glue of our relationship. But without that aspect of fixing the other, we don't have much to talk about. Like right now. Stephen, I say finally. It jogs him out of his trance. He looks at me. I don't have to say a word. He knows what's coming. He starts to cry. I do too. We cry and we hold each other and we pedal our giant fucking bird boat. Jeanette, I have the whole team for you, one of my agent's assistants tells me over the phone. Whenever the whole team is on a call, it's one of two things, very good news or very bad news. The whole team only jumps on a call to celebrate or handhold, nothing in between. One by one, each member of the whole team clicks into the conference call. I wait to find out which kind of news it is. Is everybody on? A voice asks. Yeah, we're all here, another voice says. So, Jeanette. Bad news. A pause is always bad news. Your Netflix show got canceled. Silence. It might be bad news in my agent's minds, but it doesn't sound bad to me. It sounds fine. Okay. Okay? One of the voices asks, confused. Okay, I repeat. Thanks for telling me. Okay, another voice says, sounding relieved. Well, all right then. So good news is we can start submitting you for other roles now since you're not on hold for Netflix anymore. Actually, a tense beat while they all wait to hear what's coming next. I can almost feel their fears through the phone. Is she gonna cry? Please don't let the actress cry. God help me. Actually, I've been thinking about this for a while, since we've been waiting to hear if the show got picked up for a third season. And I decided that if we got picked up, I'd do it, but if we didn't, I'd take a break from acting. Silence. Oh, a voice finally chimes in. All right, then, Are you sure? Yeah, I'm sure. Like, for sure? One of them asks. Yes, double for sure. All right, well, let us know if you change your mind. We'd love to keep sending you out for roles. I'll let you know. A few awkward goodbyes are exchanged, and then the call's over. It's as simple as that. An 18-year career ended in a 2-minute phone call. I feel at peace with the decision. Finally. I didn't at first. It's taken me over a year of mulling and back and forth with Jeff in order to get here. I've known for so long that my relationship with acting is a complicated one, not dissimilar to my relationship with food and my body. Both of them feel like constant pulling, yearning, begging, fighting. I'm trying desperately to get their approval, their affection, and I never quite seem to. I'm never quite good enough. I'm resentful of the fight and exhausted with it. I've finally started to take some control of my relationship with food, and the healthier that relationship becomes, the more unhealthy a career in acting seems for me. I understand that many aspects of any job are out of the control of the person doing it, but in acting, that's especially the case. As an actor, you can't control which agents want to represent you, what roles your agent submits you for, which auditions you get, what callbacks you get, what roles you get, what the lines are for your role, how you look for your role, how the director directs your performance, how the editor edits your performance, whether the show gets picked up or the movie does well, whether critics like your performance, whether you get famous, how the media portrays you, and so on. God bless the souls who can tolerate that much up in the airness in their lives, but I can't anymore. So much of my life has felt so out of my control for so long, and I'm done with that being my reality. I want my life to be in my hands, Not in eating disorders, or a casting director's, or an agent's, or my mom's. Mine. I love it, I say. And I'm not lying the way I did when I turned 6 and opened my Rugrats pajamas. I really do love it. I've had my backpack for 3 years and it's gotten pretty beat up looking. I've complained about it for months but haven't been able to find a decent replacement. But Miranda did. She found a beautiful black Tumi backpack with gold details. It's perfect. The only thing that beats Miranda's presence are her cards. I pull hers out to read it. Her handwriting is meticulous, her phrases are kind and simple, she always squeezes in a couple of well-placed jokes, and she always signs her cards to me as Alec Baldwin. I don't even remember where this joke came from anymore, but it still makes me laugh every time.
Should we go into Disneyland first, or should we get dinner? Miranda asks.
It's my 26th birthday. Even though Grandpa no longer works at Disney, because he worked there for 15 years, he gets an honorary lifetime supply of park sign-in passes and employee discounts. He used his discount to get me 40% off this courtyard view room we're staying at in the Grand Californian Hotel. Thanks, Grandpa. Let's go into Disneyland. Of course I choose Disneyland. And not just because it's Disneyland. If there's ever the choice between dinner and another thing, I'll choose the other thing. I'm a few years into my eating disorder recovery, but the road is still bumpy. Some weeks I don't purge, some weeks I do. The diagnostic criteria for bulimia stipulate that there must be a binging and purging sequence at least once a week for 3 months. So even though I exceed the weekly criteria sometimes, the purging is inconsistent enough that, according to Jeff, I'm no longer considered a bulimic. I'm just a person who sometimes exhibits bulimic behavior, which still doesn't sound great to me. I'm glad at least that when I do have a slip, that slip no longer spirals into a slide. That's huge progress, I know. But I keep telling Jeff that I don't want to be a person who sometimes exhibits bulimic behavior. I want to be better, sturdier, more confident in my recovery. I want to feel like I've outgrown eating disorders and they're a thing of my past. But so far, that time hasn't come. Food, the lack of it, the want of it, the lust for it, the fear of it, still takes up so much of my energy. Any mention of a meal, any reminder of one, still causes a rush of anxiety throughout my entire body. That's why if there's a choice between dinner and another thing, I always choose the other thing. I want to postpone the chaos of a meal for as long as possible. I grab my choppy auburn wig and sunglasses from the nightstand. I've started using this disguise when I go places to avoid getting recognized. Miranda and I walk to Disneyland and hop on Space Mountain, then on Matterhorn since it's close, even though neither of us likes it very much. We walk to the partner theme park, California Adventure. We ride the Guardians of the Galaxy ride and walk through the Animation Academy building, where we learn how to draw Simba. We're folding up our drawings when the inevitable happens. My stomach growls. We both laugh and agree to get dinner. Miranda knows all about my food issues. She's known for a while, since early on in my recovery when it was suggested that I tell a few trusted friends. Since then, Miranda's been very supportive. I appreciate her support, but it's also difficult at times. Before Miranda knew about this stuff, when bulimia was my secret, I could get through the ups and downs on my own. I was the only person I had to be accountable to, the only person I would disappoint. But now that she's in on the secret, I can tell she's hyper-aware of my eating tendencies. She's constantly observing. I'm not just disappointing myself with my slips, but her too. Where do you want to go? Miranda asks. Wherever there isn't a line. I just want to get the eating over with so I can brace myself for the onslaught of emotions and will my way through their intensity until they pass and I haven't purged. Hopefully. We walk to Downtown Disney, the shopping district attached to the theme parks, and head for Tortilla Joe's since they usually have the shortest line. We're seated in a corner booth and we order right away. Chips and guacamole for the table, Miranda gets some tacos, I get salmon with salad. I always think if I order the healthy thing, I have a better chance of not throwing it up after. Less shame in salmon than in a hamburger, I suppose, or I would suppose if it worked every time. But it doesn't. I'm so hungry by this point that I can't stop myself with the chips and guacamole. I tell myself just one, just two, just four, just six, but I don't stop at just one, or two, or four, or six. I keep going. I think I'm selling casualness despite what's going on in my mind. It's so annoying, eating disorder brain. Anytime I'm having a conversation with someone over a meal, there's another conversation happening internally. Judgments and criticisms and self-loathing that press on me with such severity. They're a brutal distraction. I can never be present with whoever I'm with. My focus is always more on the food than the person. I'm told that this narrative, this way of thinking, this eating disorder brain, will lessen with time. I guess we'll see. The main course has come. I can tell by the way Miranda's watching me that she knows I'm anxious. I remind myself to chew slowly, look calm, act normal. Then I excuse myself and say that I have to pee. I get to the bathroom and check under the stalls to make sure they're all empty.
I started doing this after a Disneyland trip 3 years ago when I got off Jungle Cruise and beelined for the Adventureland restroom to throw out my clam chowder. I was right in the middle of purging when a little hand poked out from under the stall next to me with her Mickey and Friends autograph book, asking me to sign it. I couldn't because I'm right-handed, and since I'd just purged, regurgitated bits of clam chowder were trickling down my arm. If those bits got on her autograph book, little Bailey would be forever changed. Luckily this time, the stalls are all empty. I have to be quick so no one catches me. I hurry into the biggest one. I shove my fingers down my throat and purge repeatedly until nothing comes up anymore. I wipe the puke off my arm with toilet paper. I hate the toilet paper on Disney property because it's very thin, so it crumples up around the vomit every time, and I have to scrub the little puke toilet paper dingleberries off my arm with more thin toilet paper, and then there are more puke toilet paper dingleberries, and then there's more scrubbing, and so on. I'm bent over the toilet bowl when I remember something Jeff told me. You don't want to be 45 at the office Christmas party with 3 kids and a mortgage sneaking into the bathroom to puke up the artichoke dip, he'd said. Sure, I'm not 45, and I don't even like artichoke dip. But it is my 26th birthday. I am getting older. I think of Mom. I don't want to become her. I don't want to live off chewy granola bars and steamed vegetables. I don't want to spend my life restricting and dog-earing Woman's World fad diet pages. Mom didn't get better. But I will. I'm standing on an excruciatingly rich Brentwood homeowner's slanted lawn. My stilettos have sunk into the grass. I should have never worn stilettos to a party on a lawn, but I don't know how to dress myself, and I no longer have Nickelodeon stylists to prepare me for events. It's dark out, and there are twinkly lights and celebrities all around me. I'm at some sort of holiday industry gathering my new manager invited me to, the manager that represents me for writing. My agents dropped me after they realized my break from acting was not going to be short-lived. I yank my heels up from the grass and make my way to the buffet table when what to my wondering eyes should appear but some miniature cheeseburgers. But I don't feel like something meaty and cheesy right now. I feel like something sweet. And these days, I pay attention to what I feel. I spot a dense, warm chocolate chip cookie. Perfect. As I chew, I realize that this is a chocolate chip cookie that I never would have allowed myself to eat in my anorexic days, and never would have allowed myself to keep down in my bulimic ones. A chocolate chip cookie that I haven't counted the calories in or had anxiety about eating. I think about how it's been over a year since I've purged, and several months that I've actually been able to find enjoyment in the food I eat. Recovery so far is, in some ways, as difficult as the bulimic alcohol-ridden years, but difficult in a different way because I'm facing my issues for the first time instead of burying them with eating disorders and substances. I'm processing not only the grief of my mom's death, but the grief of a childhood, adolescence, and young adulthood that I feel I had never truly been able to live for myself. It's difficult, but it's the kind of difficult I have pride in. Those cookies look good! I hear over my shoulder a booming voice that sounds familiar. I turn and see Dwayne The Rock Johnson. He looks so nice and Dwayne Johnson-like with his big smile. The man oozes charisma. I think about going up to him and introducing myself, reminding him of that award show years ago. Could Dwayne Johnson tell how miserable I was last time we met? Would he sense a difference now? Does he understand all the obstacles and accomplishments that this cookie represents? Is Dwayne Johnson God? I'm trying to think of something funny or witty or charming to say, but I can't. My mind freezes in social settings, especially if those settings include The Rock slash God. I miss my chance. He wanders off into the crowd. I go back to eating my cookie. Enjoying my cookie. 90. I'm eating dinner at my apartment when my phone rings. It's Miranda. Typically, I wouldn't expect a call from her these days. We've drifted apart. It's a sad reality for me in my late 20s. At the beginning of the decade, the people I was close to seemed like friends for life, people I could never imagine not seeing every day. But life happens, love happens, loss happens. Change and growth happen at different paces for different people, and sometimes the paces just don't line up. It's devastating if I think too much about it, so I usually don't. But I know why she's calling today. I've been expecting this call and just didn't know when exactly it would come. Hello? I say while I get up from the table and throw on some sneakers. Hey! We both start laughing. I can't remember the last time we spoke, yet the second we get on the phone with each other, we start laughing. I head out the front door so I can walk around the neighborhood while we chat. We fill each other in on our dysfunctional family updates and major life events, and then there's the pause, the little lull before the reason for the conversation is about to be brought up. Miranda, I'm not doing the reboot. There's nothing you can say to convince me. Well, I'm still gonna try, she laughs. I laugh too.
She tells me she thinks the reboot could be an opportunity for all of us in the cast to get back out there, maybe get some other opportunities from it. It's the same spiel I already heard from a network executive a few months back when I first learned about the iCarly reboot. I know both the executive and Miranda mean well in saying these things, but I disagree. I don't think a reboot could realistically lead to other opportunities, because if the performer in the reboot hasn't done significant work in between, the reboot just serves as a reminder of that. It further entrenches the performer in the role that they initially got known for at least a decade prior, a role which likely keeps their career stuck, not flourishing. This business is tough, and this business doesn't view a role in a reboot as a career revival. It's viewed as a career ender.
But it's really good money, Miranda tells me. I asked if they'd give you the amount I'm making, and they said yes.
Miranda's right. The network was generous in their offer, and it was kind of her to encourage that offer. I know, I say to Miranda, but there are things more important than money, and my mental health and happiness fall under that category. There's a moment of silence. It's one of those rare moments where I feel like I didn't say too much or too little. I feel like I represented myself accurately, and there's nothing I would change about the way I said it. I feel proud. We wrap up our conversation, promising to keep in touch, and hang up. I head back home to finish my dinner. Hi, Mom, I almost say out loud, but I stop myself because I don't want to look crazy to the other mourners around me. Mourner, singular, actually. There's only one, and it's the same guy I see here every time. He sits in a lawn chair with a sun umbrella over him, playing soft rock from a stereo and staring at the headstone of who I assumed to be his former wife. I look at Mom's headstone. There are about 20 adjectives on it because everyone in the family had adjective pitches and nobody was willing to forsake theirs. We've got to include playful, Grandpa insisted.
Why does nobody like brave? Brave is a good word,
Grandma wailed. So we just crammed all the words on there. Even Mom's place of death is cluttered. This is my first time visiting Mom's grave since her birthday, last July. My visits have become less frequent through the years, even though I promised Mom, per her request, that I would visit her grave every day. In the beginning, I visited once a week and felt guilty about it, like it wasn't enough. But with time and with reality, the visits have become less and less, and so is the guilt. I sit cross-legged in front of her grave. I take a longer look at the words on her headstone. Brave, kind, loyal, sweet, loving, graceful, strong, thoughtful, funny, genuine, hopeful, playful, insightful, and on and on. Was she, though? Was she any of those things? The words make me angry. I can't look at them any longer. Why do we romanticize the dead? Why can't we be honest about them? Especially moms, they're the most romanticized of anyone. Moms are saints, angels by merely existing. No one could possibly understand what it's like to be a mom. Men will never understand, women with no children will never understand. No one but moms know the hardship of motherhood, and we non-moms must heap nothing but praise upon moms because we lowly, pitiful non-moms are mere peasants compared to the goddesses we call mothers. Maybe I feel this way now because I viewed my mom that way for so long. I had her up on a pedestal, and I know how detrimental that pedestal was to my well-being and life. That pedestal kept me stuck, emotionally stunted, living in fear, dependent, in a near constant state of emotional pain, and without the tools to even identify that pain, let alone deal with it. My mom didn't deserve her pedestal. She was a narcissist. She refused to admit she had any problems, despite how destructive those problems were to our entire family. My mom emotionally, mentally, and physically abused me in ways that will forever impact me. She gave me breast and vaginal exams until I was 17 years old. These exams made my body stiff with discomfort. I felt violated, yet I had no voice, no ability to express that. I was conditioned to believe any boundary I wanted was a betrayal of her, so I stayed silent, cooperative. When I was 6 years old, she pushed me into a career I didn't want. I'm grateful for the financial stability that career has provided me, but not much else. I was not equipped to handle the entertainment industry and all of its competitiveness, rejection, stakes, harsh realities, fame. I needed that time, those years, to develop as a child, to form my identity, to grow. I can never get those years back. She taught me an eating disorder when I was 11 years old, an eating disorder that robbed me of my joy and any amount of free-spiritedness that I had. She never told me my father was not my father. Her death left me with more questions than answers, more pain than healing, and many layers of grief. The initial grief from her passing, then the grief of accepting her abuse and exploitation of me, and finally, the grief that surfaces now when I miss her and start to cry. Because I do still miss her and start to cry. I miss her pep talks. Mom had a knack for finding just the right thing in a person to get them to light up and believe in themselves. I miss her childlike spirit. Mom had an energy that could at times be so endearing, even captivating. And I miss when she was happy. It didn't happen as often as I would have liked. It didn't happen as often as I tried to force it to happen. But when she was happy, it was infectious. Sometimes when I miss her, I start to fantasize about what life would be like if she were still alive. And I imagine that maybe she'd have apologized, and we'd have wept in each other's arms and promised each other we'd start fresh. Maybe she'd support me having my own identity, my own hopes and dreams and pursuits. But then I realize I'm just romanticizing the dead in the same way I wish everyone else wouldn't. Mom made it very clear she had no interest in changing. If she were still alive, she'd still be trying her best to manipulate me into being who she wants me to be. I'd still be purging or restricting or binging or some combination of the three, and she'd still be endorsing it. I'd still be forcing myself to act, miserably going through the motions of performing on shiny sitcoms. How many times can you pratfall over a carpet or sell a line you don't believe in before your soul dies? There's a good chance I would have had a complete and public mental breakdown by this point. I'd still be deeply unhappy and severely mentally unhealthy. I look at the words again. Brave, kind, loyal, sweet, loving, graceful. I shake my head. I don't cry. The Doobie Brothers' What a Fool Believes starts playing from the sad man's stereo. I stand up, wipe the dirt off my jeans, and walk away. I know I'm not coming back. Acknowledgements. Thank you to my editor, Sean Manning, for your impact on this book, for understanding my voice and making it so much stronger. To my manager, Norma Lajim, your early support and encouragement means so much to me. Thank you for your wisdom, strategy, thoughtfulness, and unshakable calm. To Peter McGuigan and Maddie Salehi, thank you for your talent and humor and for helping to make this happen. To Jill Fritzo and everyone at Jill Fritzo PR, thank you for your brilliance and expertise. To Aaron Mason and Jamie C. Farquhar for the transformative guidance and tools you have provided me. And finally, thank you, Ari, for your endless love, support, and encouragement. I love you so much. You're my best friend. I'm so happy we're a team. Harmonizing. We are here for us. I'm Glad My Mom Died was written and read by Jeanette McCurdy. It was recorded by Tim Moore at York Recording in Los Angeles. Editing, mix, and post-production by Like 2,000 Pounds. The associate producer was Joy Asuquo. I'm Glad My Mom Died was produced and directed by Anna Chan. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. I'm Glad My Mom Died is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.